Welcome to Eye on Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 87, otherwise known as season 5, episode 9. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How are you doing, Jacob?
I'm doing great. I just celebrated my birthday this weekend.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you. I partied hard with a lot of cupcakes and horror movies.
That's the best way to do it. Also with us, as always, is your other host, John Correa. How you doing, Correa?
Happy birthday, Jacob.
No, thank you. Thank you.
How old are you now?
30.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. I forgot you had your age removed on IMDb, so we shouldn't out you here on the podcast. Yeah. Doing good. I am finally home. I haven't been home for most of May. I was in Vegas, and then I just got back from Star Wars Celebration, helping do the coverage with EW and people. So that was fun. Because of it, I finally went to Disneyland for the first time ever and did Haunted Mansion, and it was everything I ever wanted. And I made my group go on it 5 more times.
You went out 6 times?
Yeah. But the Matterhorn scared the shit out of me when that Yeti popped out.
The Matterhorn's my favorite. See, I remember the Matterhorn before it had. This is speaking of how old we are. I remember the Matterhorn before it had the Yeti.
It didn't used to have the Yeti?
Like I said, I'm old. But I remember the commercials. Yeah, it hasn't always had the Yeti. And I remember the commercials they had to introduce the Yeti. They showed it was like this ominous Matterhorn. It was dark and snowy. They go, "Something new is lurking inside the Matterhorn." And then, you know, it was the abominable snowman.
Oh, that's dope.
He's actually gotten kind of more high tech over the years. He used to be basically typical, like Pirates of the Caribbean type animatronic stuff, but now he's pretty slick. I mean, all of Disneyland, I think when they update pretty well, but
they got the technology.
Yeah, dude, it was great because it was Disney After Dark. So it was like almost 1 a.m. when we did Matterhorn. So it was dark. And like when you're going up and they do that, like the sound and like the shadow of the Yeti going up the thing, I didn't realize there was a thing next to me. So all of a sudden I looked to my right and there's just like red eyes glaring at me, and it scared the shit out of me. It was great. And then Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. That was great, man. I didn't realize that it actually took you to hell. So have the little animatronic devils and shit. Oh, I mean, the Star Wars rides were cool, but I love the old school nature of amusement park, right? Like the old ones with animatronics and all that stuff. So I was just forcing everyone to go on those, which were great.
Mr. Toad's is funny because when you go to hell, it gets hotter and it's like all hot. And then like, you're almost to the point where you're like, oh shit, it's too hot. I'm going to pass out. And then it ends and you go in and then it's like this wash of cool air hits you. Mr. Toad's when he goes to hell it's pretty effective. I used to, when I was little, the Haunted Mansion was quote the haunted house, but Snow White was the other haunted house, so to speak, because there was like that witch and the apple and all that other crap, you know?
Yeah, no, it was great. But this is a horror podcast, so enough about Disneyland.
Hey, we're talking about haunted stuff and Yetis.
Yeah, it's a horrifying world after all.
It is. We avoided the shit out of It's a Small World, though. Did not need that earworm.
Yeah, now that's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a small world is one of those ones that if you've seen it once, although, you know, it is kind of cool since they added the abominable snowman, It's a Small World. Just kidding, they didn't.
How dope would that be if they added like a Sam Squanch
monster? Yeah.
And it just suddenly, like towards the end, you just see the Sam Squanch from Night of the Demon holding, you know, what it's known for.
No, just now at the end they need Sasquatch to bust out and start ripping the melody.
There needs to just be like a Sam Squanch ride where it's just like a bunch of different Sam Squanches all throughout it. That'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, we got the Yeti on the Matterhorn, so, you know, they just went all in on Abominable Snowman, Bigfoot, Sam Squatch, all that.
They should put a Bigfoot on Big Thunder Mountain.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. That's true. Or someone just needs to make that amusement park that's in Scooby-Doo. Like, is it Scooby-Doo 2? Spooky Island? No, it's
the first one, although it wasn't the second one with, like, the Museum of Monsters or something.
That too. I'm just saying, like, the live action Scooby-Doo movies gave the world so many good ideas for like amusement parks and museums, and no one has done it yet. And that disappoints me, because there's people out there who can afford to do this, like billionaires and stuff. And what do? They just like hoard money. It's like, dude, you could make Spooky Island or Monster Museum. And yet, anyways, so who saw The Sadness?
I did.
Ooh, yeah. The Sadness is now on Shudder. And Jacob, what'd you think?
That was some heavy shit.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, The Sadness is a new virus/zombie film that's on Shudder. And it's been making its rounds as just going for it. I don't know how else to describe it. Like, they just go for it. Basically, it's like a rage virus that makes people want to kill and eat and commit sexual assault like crazy, and yeah, torture. I mean, yeah, it's definitely they go for it. They're one of the first scenes takes place on a subway, and this dude just starts stabbing the shit out of people, and then other people in the car get affected by the virus, and then they start stabbing, and then next thing you know, it's just like a dozen or so people just attacking the crap out of each other. And it's shot really well, and the effects are really dope. But and I had a little bit of this fear going into it, that sometimes when filmmakers go out to make something extremely disturbing, I feel like I get desensitized halfway through. Like, there's just so much of it going on that, like, there's no big, like, the big wow moments just kind of like, I don't know, like they lose their sparkle. That's a weird way to put it.
Yeah. It's trying too hard at a certain point.
Like, I need a little bit of buildup. You know what I mean? Like, I think prime example is Audition by Takashi Miike. That film plays out like a really bad romantic comedy for like most of the movie, which makes the last act so effective, you know, because you've just been sitting there kind of bored a little bit throughout most of it, and then all of a sudden you get the tick 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 with the piano wire and stuff. This film, it just, once it starts, it doesn't really stop. But it is really effective in its depiction of disturbing acts. What do you think?
I really liked it. And yeah, and also this is a foreign film from Taiwan. I thought it was interesting, although the other thing being that it was heavily influenced by this comic book horror series called Crossed by Garth Ennis. Did you ever read that?
No.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a similar concept, although I feel like this did a pretty good job of streamlining it, because, yeah, no, it was just kind of like started by Garth Ennis and got a bunch of different other writers, and yeah, it's a whole thing. But no, The Sadness, I felt, did a pretty good job of both kind of the buildup and maintaining the sheer horror through depravity. Yeah, no, just it's, you know, just when you think it's peaked, like the violence somehow manages to get even more extreme and depraved. So it, you know, it's I feel like it's kind of like a balancing act in that regard. Plus, you got the main plot line with the boyfriend and girlfriend trying to reunite amid the contagion. So yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely gonna not be for everyone. Like, I mean, there was quite a few scenes where even I was squeamish, but yeah, you know, it's definitely a very hardcore and kind of downbeat zombie infection type of movie.
Yeah. Like it is well made, and it is a lot of fun. It's very depraved. I could just already see it being one of those horror bro movies where it's like, oh, you didn't like The Sadness? What are you, a wussy? Blah, 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 blah. And it's like, it was fine. It was, you know, it did what it wanted to do, and they did it. They went for it. Like, that's my main thing, is that they went for it and they achieved it in making something that depicted a lot of depravity, and it was gnarly, and the effects were awesome. So, I mean, like, kudos, you know. But I can see why that's not a lot of people's cup of tea.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah.
I saw something that Jacob had talked about already a few weeks back, Watcher, the Chloe Acuna movie. It was not the movie I thought that it was going to be. I was expecting it to be kind of more of like a stalk and slash kind of a thing. It's actually pretty much of a psychological thriller. It takes a while to get to where it's going, because Micah Monroe is the heroine. And the whole movie, you're wondering if basically what it is she thinks that there's this dude who is looking at her from across the street, you know, into her apartment. And then she thinks he's following her around. And the whole movie, you're kind of wondering, you know, or she's wondering and everyone around her is wondering, is this actually happening or is it all in her head? It's like it's you're questioning her as the narrator, but also it's kind of like just an exercise in paranoia and kind of gaslighting too, mm-hmm. because the people around her are like, are you sure that you know, he lives in the neighborhood? Are you sure that you didn't just both end up in the same place at the same time? Kind of a deal. And you really don't get any answers until the third act. Now the third act absolutely pays off. So, so, you know, be patient with it because it does move kind of slowly until you get there. But you do get your answers but it's weird because the whole time you're like, okay, which is it? Because it does kind of paint the movie kind of gaslights you about the gaslighting that this girl is going through. Cause you're like, well, maybe she is imagining this. I don't know. It's pretty well done as far as that goes. You know, it's some of the, like you talk about the horror bros are going to be like, well, that movie was boring as shit. It's like, well, if all you want is, you know, screaming and, you know, boobs, yeah, it's boring, but it's not, you know, it's not even, you almost hesitate to call it a horror movie until that third act, because it's just more of like the pacing reminded me of Swallow, you know, and also it's also an IFC Midnight movie. So that kind of makes sense because IFC does have a type, but yeah, it was cool. I did like it.
And also I thought it was interesting that it played up kind of the culture shock in story, because the whole thing is that the lead character moves to Romania for her boyfriend and she's out of place, and they kind of and you know, they just kind of lean into that.
That kind of adds to the gaslighting too, because you're because also there are no subtitles. So people will be speaking Romanian around her and you're basically stuck in her head because she doesn't know what they're saying.
Right.
And then she'll say, what did he say? And it's the same thing you're wondering too. So, I mean, I'm sure it was a conscious decision to not let the audience into what they're saying, unless you happen to speak Romanian, but you know, that's not one of the huge languages, you know, like Spanish or, you know, French that people speak, unless you're native Romanian.
Right. As for me, I had a fun time celebrating my birthday this weekend by going to the Friday Night Frights Animals Attacks Marathon.
Ooh, that was one of those secret ones, right? Where they didn't really sell the titles.
Yep, Secret 16. And yeah, these were all 16 millimeter movies and we didn't know what we were going to get. But here's how it ended up. We got the 90s genetically modified dog movie, Man's Best Friend, the British killer bee movie, The Deadly Bees from the 60s, the 90s star-studded snake classic, Anaconda, British Canadian cat anthology or catthology, if you will, the Uncanny, the bummer Jaws knockoff from Dino De Laurentiis, Orca, and the piece de resistance, the one that killed the franchise, Jaws the Revenge.
Wow, that is a solid as fuck lineup.
Yes, it is.
Oh yeah, no, it was a good time, and we got like pretty much one different animals from the animal kingdom in different horror scenarios.
I haven't seen Man's Best Friend, but I remember the commercial when it came out and it used to crack me up because basically what it is this St. Bernard. I think it's a St. Bernard. It's St. Bernard, right?
No, I don't think it's a St. Bernard. I can't remember what breed it is.
Okay, but he's a big dog.
Yeah, he's a big dog.
He chases a cat and the cat goes up the tree and everyone's like, oh yeah, the cat got away from this dog. Then the dog climbs the tree.
Yeah, it's been genetically crossbred with, or it's got the genes of a cheetah. So like it's got claws.
So he climbs the tree and he basically swallows this cat whole.
Yeah, because he also has snake DNA.
How many different DNAs are in this dog?
Many DNAs. Like the dog can also pee acid and it's got chameleon camouflage and infrared vision. So it's like just a whole mishmash of animal DNAs.
So he's part predator and part xenomorph as well.
I was about to say, where does the acid pee come from? What animal does that?
I don't know. It just does.
Zoologist.
I mean, the funny thing about, and if I'm remembering this wrong, let me know, but there are a couple of kids watching this happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And the kids witness it.
Yeah. And so when it eats the cat whole, these kids just, they go from laughing to like screaming their heads off.
Yeah. And I was like, because they're like, oh, the dog's chasing the cat. Oh my God, that dog just swallowed that cat whole.
Jeez. Oh. See, that's one of those movies that I have on VHS that like I just got in a big box and just haven't gotten around to yet. And you guys just sold the shit out of it. I'm probably going to watch that today.
Yeah, no, it's a goofy movie, and it's definitely knows like it's when it's being funny. And also, I'd say out of all the animals that night, Max, the genetically modified dog, got the most aws because he's a killing machine. But when he's, you know, being friendly, he's a cute puppy.
Well, it's like Cujo.
Yes.
Before Cujo gets rabies, he's adorable. Although the movie kind of cheapens it because the movie, he gets rabies in the first scene. But if you read the book to Cujo, yeah, there's a whole opening thing where it talks about how lovable and how good a dog he is. And then he gets rabies. So it's almost like Old Yeller when you're like, oh, this, you know, but the movie starts off with him getting rabies and you're like, oh, you know, there's gotcha. They don't try to, I mean, you can't really say humanize because he's a dog, but they don't, you know, humanize Cujo as much as the book does. The book is heartbreaking in that regard.
Yeah. No, it sounds like a bummer. But yeah, no, some of the other highlights though, it had been like at least, over a decade since I'd seen Anaconda. So that was a fun one to revisit, especially John Voight, you know, just like going as hard as possible as the weird, South American hunter guy, complete with an accent that sounds like a cross between Tony Montana and Strong Bad. Like because he says something like, the snake squeeze you and like a lover until your bones explode. And there's just all these shots, like I completely forgot about this, that just close-ups of John Voight's sneering face and just being like, you know, just staring at the screen or leering at Jennifer Lopez for like several seconds and just being weird.
Yeah, that's a weird movie. That was one of those I somehow found a copy of that on Blu-ray at Dollar Tree, so I revisited that during the pandemic. And yeah, it's such a fun and weird movie. The 90s were the best for just like, hey, we can do effects now. So yeah, let's do all the creature features again to various levels of success.
Also, that was my first time seeing Jaws the Revenge in full.
Mm.
Yeah. And yeah, though I can see why it killed the franchise. Because it's like you got the shark somehow tracking Mrs. Brody and her remaining son and family to the Bahamas, and the shark doesn't really do a whole lot except for like appearing in psychic visions and occasionally attacking them. And like, yeah, very low body count in this one. And it focuses a lot on the family drama stuff, and also Ms. Brody starring a romance with Michael Caine, who plays a jet pilot named Hoagie. And it's just they really missed the mark hard on this. Also, now I've seen every Jaws movie on film, 1 through 4. I've seen them all on film now.
Good job, bud.
Yeah. And I'd say probably the other highlight of the night was the uncanny, because it's an Amicus anthology, but post Amicus from the same people, but it's all themed around cats. So every story is like cats, again, come up in some people or, you know, causing chaos. And Peter Cushing's really good as the framing narrator guy, who's like this conspiracy theorist who believes that cats are evil and like taking over the world.
The Uncanny slaps. Like that is great anthology film. Like it's the very in that classic Amicus style, like Tales from the Crypt and whatnot. And like, yeah, when Severin put that Blu-ray out a few years ago, that was an instant buy because it's just so good. It's gothic and just fun.
Yeah, no, I love the story where Donald Pleasance plays an actor who kills his wife so that he can get with her younger understudy, and the cat his wife's cat is like out for revenge against him in kind of like a Looney Tunes Bugs Bunny style. Because yes. The cat starts sabotaging his scenes and tries to kill him.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. No, it's great.
I finally watched Studio 666.
Ooh.
And I bought it digitally because I wanted to watch it in 4K. And I knew it wasn't going to be. I knew it was going to be a comedy, right? Like I knew it was going to have that. I knew the Foo Fighters weren't actors. I didn't realize that everybody involved was going to be so aware of that. Like the Foo Fighters are not actors, and they like embraced that full heartedly. And it was one of those ones where I'm like, I feel like I'm going to like this, but I feel like I'm going to have to put in a little bit of effort to like give it a shot. And that movie just stole my heart. Like it is just genuine and just like goofy fun and silly. And yeah, no, it made me want to like revisit the Foo Fighters catalog more. Like I feel like, you know, and then nothing against the Foo Fighters, just never really like deep dove into their catalog past the first album. So, but yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. The blood was just flooding and the humor was on point, and it reminded me a lot of the old Tenacious D show and like a lot of their things. So I was a little
Dave
sad.
Grohl was on that,
right? Exactly. You could kind of tell that Dave Grohl had either a similar sense of humor or you know took what he learned from those guys into this. But I was a little sad I didn't see them cameo. But yeah, the John Carpenter with J-Tro as the engineers was a lot of fun.
I also was a big fan of Will Forte's cameo as the dweeby delivery guy.
I just, oh man, the ongoing joke about ranch, like just the ranch. Random shit like that. Just like, hey, I ordered extra ranch, you know, with Dave going and closes the door and like they kind of find his dead body, but not really. Dave just picks up the ranch. He's like, you can never have enough ranch. Like his delivery was perfect. And yeah, it was a great blend of just like super bloody horror comedy with like them just being the most rock dads ever. Yeah.
Yeah. And they definitely leaned into the horror homages because like there's the whole thing with like the gardener ghost guy who's basically a Cropsey from The Burning. Like he's got the shears and the hat. Yeah. And there's some gnarly kills in that movie. Like they go for it.
Oh, dude, and the chainsaw death scene,
Christ.
And they actually used a song that features chainsaws in it called Chainsaw. Yeah, there were some deep cuts with the music in it too, which were phenomenal.
I really dug it. It was kind of like, yeah, like it also reminded me of This Is the End, you know, with a bunch of celebrities playing themselves in a horror scenario, and it was just them having some fun.
Yeah.
Another thing that all three of us have seen and is going to lead into our topic is on Shudder, the found footage phenomenon. What do you guys think of the found footage phenomenon?
I dug it. You know, I thought that in terms of documentaries, I thought it was a pretty good dive into the subgenre and a good way of kind of examining the history, because they even talk as far back as Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, since that was presented as journals.
Yep. And Dracula, how it's presented as like letters. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So I feel like it was pretty comprehensive, and they had a good slate of filmmakers and people within that world to talk with, like Diodato, you know, did Cannibal Holocaust, and Eduardo Sanchez from Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, the Blair Witch guys. And I was stoked about this. They talked to the Last Broadcast guys who supposedly just beat the Blair Witch Project to the punch. And the films are very similar, but it's funny because there was a big controversy at the time that Blair Witch ripped off Last Broadcast. But the Last Broadcast guy actually says in this movie, he admits, he's like, oh, look, if you send if you send 100 monkeys up a hill with a typewriter, two of them are going to come down with the same thing. So he even says it's kind of a case of spontaneous inspiration
that there's something in the air.
Yeah. He was like, I was actually glad to see that, because I feel like And I also feel like that might have been someone whispering in their ears, like the Blair Witch Project ripped you off. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Blair Witch, I don't think they had enough time to have seen Last Broadcast and then made their own movie. I don't know. I never really bought that it was a ripoff.
I mean, both of them, because that's the thing, too, because one of the things I really liked about, because I famously, I'm not a big found footage horror fan, or just found footage in general. But, you know, I've calmed down on my very strong opinions on that over the years. But one of the things that I really liked was that they did go into about how trends and techniques can happen. But when it comes to filmmaking, you can make something and it be completed and it not be released due to, you know, politics or just studio trends or just someone or people just not buying it yet. So there was a few instances where you had, so like, I think they talked to the filmmakers of Apartment 143 and how they used a lot of techniques for found footage and angles and stuff that hadn't been used yet, but the studios purposely waited until more found footage came out so that they could ride that second or third wave of it. And by the time that happened, you had, because like they made theirs not long after Paranormal Activity came out or two. And then by the time they did, it was after the first one. And then by the time it came out, like the second one had already come out and like it was about to, they released it around the time of the third, especially around then, because they were pumping out a Paranormal Activity movie for years.
So, every year they were. Yeah. It was like Saw. They were doing them every year. Yeah.
Yeah. It was either you're seeing Saw or you're seeing Paranormal Activity. So I really dig, you know, when they get more behind with these documentaries, when they get more behind the scenes and like how things work. And I really dug how they got into like, yeah, Blair Witch came out and then no one wanted to try to make Blair Witch. Even the sequel to it didn't try to do Blair Witch. And then, of course, they addressed, you know, that big shift that happened with 9/11 and how we had a lot more real life horror coming out on, you know, video cameras and the rise of the internet and how that's all kind of affected it. So I'm always interested in more so in the ones that go into why these trends happen, how they happen, and like some historical context to it, more so than just, oh yeah, and this movie's a part of it and it's that genre and it's really good. You know, basically I hate it when people do documentaries like how we do this podcast, you know. I need more depth. No.
You know, it's funny because I love how much time they spent on the pre-Blair Witch Project stuff, you know, Man Bites Dog, McPherson tapes, you know, Cannibal Holocaust, Ghost Watch,
or even like before all that, David Holtzman's Diary, the, you know, CalArts Cinema Verte art house movement title that was considered proto found footage, you know?
Yeah. I have one bone to pick with the found footage phenomenon, because they were saying that the original found footage movie was Peeping Tom. And I do not agree with that, because Peeping Tom, for anyone who hasn't seen Peeping Tom, it's about a guy who basically attaches like a knife kind of a thing to a camera. And his thing is he likes to kill women, and he captures the moment of death on film as he does it. And sure, it shows a lot of the filming he does, but that's not found footage, because it's just basically giving you the POV of the narrative.
Right.
So when they were saying that, I was like, no, that's not right. But then they say the next one basically is Cannibal Holocaust. And I do agree with that, because even though there are narrative parts of Cannibal Holocaust, the whole movie is built around this expedition into the jungle to find this. Basically, they're looking for this lost film crew, and what they find is their footage. So that's actually kind of the epitome of found footage, honestly.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like when you talk about slashers and proto slashers, you know, you mentioned people tend to mention like Psycho and Texas Chainsaw, which, you know, aren't that full formula, because it was, you know, Halloween that established and was ripped off to no ends that the formula, but there were films before it that had those elements. So Peeping Tom is not found footage, but you saw the skeleton of it. And yeah, those POV shots, because it's a knife at the end of the tripod. So it's like just out of like at the bottom of the frame, and those scenes are harrowing still. It's a beautifully shot film. It ruined his career, but the director,
well, it ruined his career because it was too edgy for that, because this was just
it was X-rated.
Yeah, this was just before Psycho. Yeah, and it was the British filmmaker Michael Powell. Yeah. And it's just before Psycho, so the world wasn't ready for it yet.
Yeah, and it's one of those cases of those early violent films that just look too good. Like Psycho gets away with it because it's a bit grimy and
black and white.
And in black and white, Peeping Tom, gorgeous colors, and you had and like oftentimes the victims were like in their bras and like underwear and stuff, so like there was a lot of like that sex component to the violence too, and it's slow. Like it's not a quick slash and run. It's you're watching it from his camera as he's slowly coming in with that point of the tripod. And so you're just in that moment for a long time. So I can see how that is very shocking, especially to, you know, audiences that aren't used to that level of violence on screen.
And it's the slow realization by these women that they're being killed. And that's what he's capturing.
Yeah, because it's all about fear and voyeurism.
Yeah, exactly. So if you haven't seen Peeping Tom, see it. It's
phenomenal.
Awesome.
Yeah, and on that note, like I do think it's interesting they kind of talked into the appeals of found footage, because, you know, it's like, again, you know, it's a voyeurism thing. It's like it's presented as real. And I forget who said it, but somebody put it best that, you know, that, you know, a lot of the most successful found footage feels like something you should not be watching. And, you know, I think they brought it up at a point with like Cannibal Holocaust that, you know, like this is this feels like something that, you know, that is on the underground. And, you know, the modern day, it's like, you know, a lot of it ties into these ideas of snuff films, you know, like recorded murders, you know, just seeing the worst of humanity on record. And, you know, then you got stuff like the Poughkeepsie tapes and, you know, like the Unfriended 2 dark web stuff. So it is interesting how it kind of plays into kind of the psychological and I guess maybe moral depths of humanity, because, you know, it's like you know, when they were talking about the post 9/11 stuff, you know, just we were seeing a lot of footage out of the Middle East, and you know, like there was the whole debate about torture. You know, as George W. Bush famous said, we don't torture. So, you know, a lot of so combined with Hostile, you know, there was you know, a lot of torture porn movies, which tied into found footage torture porn movies, which is how we got stuff like Hate Crime, the movie.
The turning point with found footage was obviously the Blair Witch Project.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny because you look at some of the movies that came before it, you know, like the McPherson tapes or even The Last Broadcast, and they didn't quite catch on. The reason the Blair Witch Project did, and I've said this time and time again, I'll go, you know, this is a hill I'll die on, the marketing. The Blair Witch Project, without the marketing, it's not really that great of a movie. You need the mythology. And they even talk about this in the documentary where I think it was Eduardo Sanchez built the website, either him or Dan Myrup, one of the two guys built the website. And it basically said, you know, this is real. This is our footage. And it went viral, and the internet was pretty new. This was, you know, 98, 99. The internet was pretty new. So they put up, you know, the mythology of the area, which they had completely created. And then they put up, you know, the story of the filmmakers. And then I remember this, they put up scenes from it. And one of them was Heather's confessional scene. And I remember at the time watching that, and I couldn't sleep that night. I'm a holy crap. And then at the time I was active on the Snopes.com message boards, which back then it wasn't so much debunking internet myths as it was more urban legends and stuff. So it was a little more, it wasn't nearly as popular as it was today. So it wasn't quite as toxic. And somebody there posted the Haxan Disney.com website where it lifts the curtain and tells you, okay, this is fake. And that's when I first realized it was fake. But holy cow, when I thought it was real, I'm like, holy crap. You know, and first thing I was thinking is, how they get the rights to release this film? You know, I'm like, aren't these people's families suing or anything? You know, but
yeah.
But movies like, you know, like even The Last Broadcast, which was a year before, if they had had the internet push that Blair Witch did, it probably would have been a lot bigger. Or, you know, Ghost Watch, you know, they probably would have been a lot bigger. And I still say to this day, there will never be another Blair Witch project there. You're never going to fool the public like that again. You know, even Paranormal Activity, which they even say in the documentary, they say Paranormal Activity came out, what was it, 2007, maybe? Yeah. Enough time had passed that there were enough people who had not seen the Blair Witch Project. So they got some of them. But most people who saw it were like, ah, this is just another found footage. You know, I mean, it's scary as hell, but no one's buying that this really happened.
Well, and that's the thing too. All these titles that we talk about as highlights, one of the reasons why they're so popular is because they were one of the first to do it, and they were able to convince, at least in some part, that it's real. You know, Cannibal Holocaust, because of, you know, the time with, and they discussed this in the documentary, with all the footage coming out of Vietnam and the real animal violence that happens early in the film, you buy into, you know, the end very, you know, much so. And no one had really done anything like that before. Blair Witch with the internet and everything, or even Ghost Watch, you know, just using the formula of like a news broadcast on the BBC, which is, you know, the truth, you know.
And it was on Halloween night. Yeah. Ghost Watch did fool people. Ghost Watch totally fooled people. But also Cannibal Holocaust fooled people because it was in the actor's contract, so they couldn't appear in anything else for a year.
Right.
And the director had to actually bring the actors out of hiding because he got put on trial for murder. And yeah, he's like, oh, they're not dead. Here they are.
Yeah. Well, and Blair Witch did the same thing too, only not a full year. I think it was like a couple weeks. Like 2 weeks after the actors started doing the circuits.
Yeah, know? because then they all started doing the promo for it. Right. But yeah, they and I remember this actually kind of gave me chills at the time. When you would look up Blair Witch on IMDb, behind each of the actors, it would say deceased after their name. And I remember just going, holy crap, that's really spooky. Because at this point I knew it was fake, but I'm like, dude, someone at IMDb is either doesn't know it's fake or is screwing with people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I was also going to add what really helped the Blair Witch Project was that they had a media storm, I guess, like, because there was also the documentary about the Blair Witch Project, Curse of the Blair Witch, which aired on TV, like kind of a in search of documentary. And yeah, the website, which had all the lore and a lot of the history of the Blair Witch Project. So, you know, they were able to create this weapon and clandestinely, you know, like have all this mythology released online and on TV. So, you know, people learn a little bit more. So, yeah, it just really hooked people in.
Yeah, I think it snowballed when, you know, when hype started building about the film. And then I remember at the time that it sold, it was the most profitable, I want to say independent movie, but it might've been the most profitable movie ever made in terms of percentage of how much it costs to make versus how much it actually made at the box office. You know, when you do the percentages, I think it was at the time the most popular movie ever made, or the most profitable.
Until Paranormal Activity.
Did Paranormal Activity throw in it? Okay.
Oh yeah, dude, that movie was made for like next to nothing, pretty much, and was shot on weekends, you know, using, you know, consumer grade cameras. And that's the thing too, is found, as much of a not fan of found footage as I am, I do respect the hell out of the use of technology in them. And that's always been, when you get the next wave is when there's a new technology that comes out to make it more real, like a new consumer grade camera or, you know, something along those lines is generally what pushes it. So like, you know, Paranormal Activity was, you know, kind of hitting around that time when people started putting cameras up around their house, you know, just to have, cause they became more readily available and whatnot. And if you look at the Paranormal Activity movies, they keep evolving with that, you know, whether it's security cameras in the second one, or in the third one, when they go back in time with the VHS tapes, you know, which was, I still respect the shit out of them putting a
fan.
the fan bit was, oh, it's so good.
It's so, and they use it so well.
Yeah. And then they fail so miserably in the fourth one with that fucking Xbox Kinect.
It ditches dating,
which, there was some effective moments with that and was really cool seeing, like, you know, the figure come up with the green dots, but it was also the cheesiest fucking bit ever. It just reminded me of, like, the Wiz when he's like, I got the power glove, you know, but that's the thing about found footage is it's that constant convincing, you know, or at least that trying to feed into that narrative that this is real, you know, that this is happening. So the second you see CGI, you're kind of taken out of it. And I think the only film that's effective in, like, not really in, like, portraying that it's real, but not really caring is Troll Hunter. Cause Troll Hunter, like, the CGI is a bit rough in that movie. It always has been. And it doesn't matter because it's done so well. Like, I think when I saw Troll Hunter in theaters, I compared it to watching Jurassic Park for the first time. And just, like, believing that these giant, you know, mythological creatures, well, dinosaurs aren't myths, but you know what I mean. genetically created dinosaurs is modern mythology, are real. And that was really cool. And I think we're seeing the next wave of found footage being these tech horror movies. Jacob, you already mentioned Unfriended Dark Web. You know, we got the Unfriended series, we got Searching and Hosts. Because, like, they're not found footage. No one's finding this Zoom recording of these people who had a seance, you know, we're supposedly watching it in real time or as it happens with a lot of these. So, I mean, it's not found footage, but it is still, I would put those in a similar genre, at least just saying that, like, you know, they're trying to use technology to feed, you know, the narrative that this is real, this happened.
I would call it found footage just because it's the name of the genre, and it doesn't necessarily mean that, oh, this was found under this tree buried in the woods. No, I mean, I like movies like Mungo Lake or Megan is Missing. They're flat out documentaries, but I think they're found footage too, just because that's the name of the genre. So I would call it found footage. The interesting thing about, once Blair Witch Project was so profitable, the market was flooded with found footage movies, flooded. And you had to wade. I'm a sucker for found footage movies, but I have to admit that I see more bad than good because I'll always watch them hoping to find the next good one. And they are more bad than good because anybody can make them. You know, I mean, we all probably have the equipment. I mean, you could make one with your iPhone. I think it was the McPherson Tapes guy who they talked about. He had just graduated from film school and his friend is like, oh, I want to invest in your movies. Oh, great, great. How much you got? And his friend's like, $5,000. He's all, I can't even rent a camera for $5,000. You know, but but he's like, okay, the only way we're going to do this for this money is using a camcorder.
Yeah.
And that's what he did, you know, and, you know, he was able to, you know, make the McPherson tapes for that, which, you know, I think Blair Witch was made for even less, like well less than that.
Yeah.
I mean, wasn't Blair Witch made for like $600 or something like that? I mean, the most expensive thing was probably the processing for the
footage
for the actual film.
Well, and that's the thing too, is that found footage, it's a double-edged sword because they said it really well in the documentary that there are big budget found footage films or movies or big budget movies that utilize the found footage format. End of Watch, Cloverfield. I'm surprised they didn't bring up what was the superhero one?
Chronicle.
Yeah, they didn't mention that one, but they use the format, but you'll never get that like sense of real, because obviously it's not real if it's Jake Gyllenhaal running around, you know, with Michael Pena, you know. So
that's the other thing. They said that they're more effective if you have unknown actors. Yeah.
And no money. Yeah.
Yeah. They basically put them into two categories. There's the big budget ones that aren't trying to fool you. And then there are the other ones that are trying to fool you, which Jacob brought up Hate Crime earlier. And that was one that I actually, from seeing this documentary, it's on Tubi. I actually tracked it down because it interested me. And basically it's about a Jewish family who's celebrating one of the kids' birthdays. And then three Nazis break into their house. It's like a home invasion movie. And the camcorder from them doing the birthday party is still running the whole time.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's pretty flawed. You can tell that it is. I mean, like when they tie up the family, the ropes are all loose and you're like, you could get away. You could get away. But it's one of those ones. And this is the most effective found footage is, and Blair Witch does this too, where it starts right at the, there's no title card. And then the title card comes at the end. And what they do with Hate Crime is they say, this camcorder is found at the side of the road with this tape in it. And you're like, you know, so, and that's when you start going, okay, this is now creepy. You know, when you think maybe it was real. Now this is post Blair Witch Project. So it doesn't really fool anyone.
Yeah.
But just the fact that you're like, okay, this, and the director even said in Found Footage Phenomenon, he said what he basically shot in Hate Crime, because he's Jewish. He said, what I shot was my nightmare, you know, and you're like, okay, you know, this is, yeah, I mean, I can see that situation would be absolutely horrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was a lot of those, especially around that time, that kind of focused on societal fears and less the supernatural and like, I guess, man's inhumanity against man. Like the big one they focused on was Michael Goy's Megan is Missing, which he said, you know, he was just inspired by watching, you know, news reports about abductions and, you know, stranger danger online. And
well, what really inspired him is a friend of his owned like a forbidden image website kind of a thing.
Oh, right. Right.
And he got one of the images at the end. One of the images that they show the actress in Megan is Missing, he said that basically is that's inspired by an image that was shown to him by his friend, and his friend showed him and he's like, you got to go to the cops with this. And he did. And it turned out that it was an actual girl who had been abducted and murdered. So, and that was the inspiration for it. So, you know, when they say based on a true story for Megan is Missing, you know, Megan is Missing is, I don't even have kids and it affected me so hard. The last 20 minutes of it is just heartbreaking. Ugh. Have you seen it, Korea?
No, it's been on my Vudu for a while now. So, yeah, I know I didn't watch a lot of found footage before I recorded it, mostly just the documentary going off, but, I did buy a VHS of The Last Broadcast. So I'm looking forward to watching that for the first time.
Last Broadcast is it's very Blair Witchy. It's about some guys who go into the woods to hunt the Jersey Devil. Basically, I think they call it something else, but the Jersey Devil. But it's pretty good. It's like, it's sort of like a true crime thing. You know, they're trying to track down what happened to these guys. You know, there's actual voiceover narration and they talk about, you know, stuff. But the last act gets a little film schooly.
Yeah. But I mean, it going back to what I was saying about the double-edged sword of found footage is you have to make it cheap. You have to make it with unknowns, both in front and behind the camera, because, you know, M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit, besides, you know, the amazing Catherine Hahn, you know, had like a bunch of little known or unknown actors in it. But still, the entire time you're sitting there going, it's a Shyamalan film. It's a Shyamalan film. So it's not going to sell it as real. But the problem is when you go too low budget or you go, you know, too unknowns, you get the unrefined mistakes that won't help sell it, you know? And I think that's sometimes it works in its favor, like Paranormal Activity, you know, where it's just like, oh man, this was just so rough made and rough put together that like it helps sell it. But sometimes it doesn't, because sometimes you're just like, I love the McPherson tape movies, both of them, but like especially the second one, I'm just like, oh man, the acting is a little rough in this. And it's a double-edged sword because it's a lot of work. People, you know, there are certain things that you can do on the cheap and have it be effective, but it's kind of like whenever I get the argument from musicians who want me to direct a music video, which happens every now and then, I don't know why, but I've made a few, but they're not that great. But and they go like, oh, I have $500. Let's make a thing. And it's like, cool. We can go out there with an iPhone and shoot you rapping at the camera, walking down the street for the entirety of the song. And we can make it look cool doing that and all that. But it's also been done before. And so how effective is it going to be if it's been done before? And with found footage also, you do still have to have a basic understanding of filmmaking. You still need to know how to light things to be able to see it. With found footage, the camera is not only capturing what's there, but you're also acting with the camera. So you're asking the cameraman to do multiple jobs, i.e. make sure that, you know, you're capturing what needs to be captioned, but also emote with the camera. It's a really, and I'm glad that they got into this in the documentary, that it is a hard dance to do.
The camera is a character.
Yeah. And it's rough because sometimes when you don't have that money or the knowledge on how to do stuff, you lose out on things like, I will admit, I operated a camera on a found footage film as my senior thesis with a group of other individuals, and we made it on the cheap. It was like less than 10 grand. And we had some like really cool stuff, but it was hard because, you know, you're fighting certain things. Like I was like, oh, dude, we got to light up this hallway more so that we can see what's going on. So we can see, you know, the creepy ghosts and stuff that's happening. And they're like, no, it's found footage. We can't have camera. No, we can have it be in organic places. No, we can't. And then you get to post and it's like, oh, we can't see anything. And it's like, well, you can always darken the image. You can't pull light out of it. And so that's one of the things that ends up being real rough. And I also find that a lot of found footage films just don't know how to end. And it's understandable because you're trying to sell that it's real. There's two things that always can take you out of it is, why is the camera still rolling? And then how it ends. So there's ones like The Devil Inside, I think, where it just suddenly cuts out.
And it actually says on there, for the rest of the story, go to this website. Is that the one?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And like,
oh my God. And now the website's not even there anymore.
But like, it makes sense that you would, right, that it would just suddenly cut out, like, you know, just be unfinished. You know, it's kind of like when you watch, you know, it's 3 a.m. and you're watching dash cam footage and like you miss a certain part because it stopped recording, you know, the camera stopped, and like that happens. But that's not satisfying for a moviegoer because you need that third act. You need that climax. You need that ending. And but like, so like I don't fault them in sticking to the, oh, this is real because it cut out footage. It makes sense. It does. But like storytelling 101, you need an ending, you know? So like it's a double-edged sword of just like, yeah, you got to make it for as low budget and make it as real as possible. But also you have to have, you know, the necessities of making a film and the storytelling and the pieces all there. And so when people pull it off, it is impressive as fuck. I mean, Bobcat Goldthwait's Willow Creek is absolutely phenomenal in that like three quarters of the movie is just a couple fighting on their honeymoon.
And so it actually seems like something you would see in like a vacation film. Yeah,
exactly. And then so then when you start getting the vocalization from the Sam Squatch just out in the woods, it is you can, there's a part of you that's like, oh, that's just Bobcat out in the woods going, ah. But also it's terrifying. I grew up in the woods, man. You would hear weird shit all the time. We had Fisher cats. They sound like crying babies. Imagine just being in the pitch dark and just hearing a baby cry out in the distance. It's terrifying.
Yeah, no. And Willow Creek has one of the best scares of any found footage movie. It's very brilliant. Just that long take that just goes on. It just keeps on building the tension. Like if it's like 6 or 7 minutes long.
Oh, in the tent?
Yeah, the tent.
With the vocalizations and then like the rustling of the tent. Oh, we've all been there. We've all been camping and there's like rakins outside, raccoons just like fucking around with the camp. And like, it's terrifying, man.
They go into it in the documentary, but the bottom line is you need an idea. You need not only a story idea, but you need an idea of how to present it. Because they say, more than one filmmaker that they talked to said, there's got to be an organic reason for the cameras to be rolling. Yes. And that's what you got with Blair Witch, because they were making this movie. Now, granted, when they get lost, would you actually keep rolling the camera? I think it was a therapeutic thing. So I buy that they do. But, you know, what else are you going to do? You're lost in the woods. You know, let's roll film. But yeah, I think that's what, you know, and the thing about found footage, and let's end this with, I want to give a shout out to the guy who makes the Bad Ben movies, because the thing about found footage is anyone can do it. And this dude, I mean, these movies are not great. You know, they're borderline not even good, but the fact that basically one guy does these things, and I think there's 7 or 8 of them now, and a lot of them are the same. Sometimes, you know, they're I think that he just keeps going back for more, but he can do that because he's doing them himself. He's not, he doesn't have to hire a crew. You know, he acts in them, he shoots them, he edits them, he scores them. You know, he's like one dude. So, I mean, hey, hats off to that dude. All right. Final thoughts on found footage.
Well, I feel like, this is not the end of found footage. You know, that this is a subgenre that reinvents itself and keeps on going. Like, you know, we got dash cam coming from Rob Savage, the guy that did Host. And I actually saw that out of Panic Fest. I thought it was pretty fun. And then you got all the creepypasta subculture stuff recently, which I feel kind of builds on that. And even possibly, if you count it, We're All Going to the World's Fair, it kind of hits a lot of those spots. So I feel like, you know, found footage never dies. It just advances.
Oh yeah. It's not going anywhere because it's so cheap to make. I mean, seriously, that's what it's so cheap to make people. And especially now that you don't really need a big studio to release your movies.
True.
You know, anybody can get a movie on Amazon, and that's how I think the Bad Ben guy does it. It's not now whether or not all these movies that are getting made are good. That's another thing, because you have to, found footage is one of those genres that, because anyone can do it, it's so diluted with crap that you have to wade through the crap to get to, you know, to get to the corn, I guess. That's kind of a gross way to put it, but.
I view found footage as I do undead, and I say undead because, you know, vampires and zombies both same, but found footage, undead movies, and Christmas movies, they will always be a constant stream of them. They will always, you know, be an oversaturation almost. I think found footage will have more like dips and bends, but like, it's kind of, they're always going to be made because they can be made so cheap, and they're, you know, with that. But the cool thing about found footage films is, like we talked about, is that it's always attached to technology in some way. And so the second we see some new technology out there, there's a found footage film that incorporates it as part of it, you know. And I think, yeah, the new tech horror with Searching and We're All Going to the World's Fair with the creepypastas are like kind of the next evolution of that. So I think it'll be interesting to see how where people go with it now, whether it's, you know, maybe we'll start seeing long format, you know, narratives via live stream, you know, found footage style. That could be the next big thing. I don't know. But either way, you're right. There is more crap than there is good out there. So I'm going to keep being a bit hesitant. You know, when found footage works, it works hard, it works good. So like, I always love a good scare.
Cool. Let's leave it at that. So our theme music is by Restless Spirit, so check them out. And our artwork is by Chris Fisher, so check him out. You can find us on any of the socials at Eye on Horror or at ihorror.com. So let us know what your favorite found footage movies are. Let us know, you know, if am I wrong that Peeping Tom is not the first found footage movie? Let me know. And please watch the found footage phenomenon. Even if you're not that into the genre, it's one of those movies, Kriya and I were joking about it earlier. It's one of those movies where you're watching it and it gives you ideas of stuff you want to see. Like I said, I watched Hate Crime after seeing, you know, found footage phenomenon. He went and got that, that one student, that, what is it, Jonathan Orvod's diary, you know.
You're so close. David Holtzman. Sorry.
David Holtzman's.
Yeah, David Holtzman's diary. Yeah.
It's such a weird name. But anyway, yeah. It's one of those movies that you always, you know, you're going to go away with something that you want to see from it. So
yeah,
check it out.
And again, I'm someone who just in general does not like found footage films, but this documentary is fucking awesome. It definitely did not convince me to watch a lot of those movies. But, you know, they definitely highlighted a few that like I needed on my radar, like David Holtzman's Diaries and The Last Broadcast. So, you know,
Man Bites Dog.
Yeah. Oh, I've seen that one. Yeah, that's such a twisted movie.
So at the end of the day, it's a very educational documentary on found footage.
Yeah. Very much. And it's cool because it's not just, it's not it, like the title says, it's more of just, it's more than a genre. It's a phenomenon. So there you go. and that's where we'll leave it. So, so check out Found Footage Phenomenon on Shudder, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. So for me, James Shea Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
And I'm Jonathan Correa.
Keep your eye on horror.